week of January 15th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 351, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gill. Sperling, is there a show next week?
There is a show next week, mainly because my future career trajectory has been upended.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you know my big dream, Michael, has always been to run away and join the circus.
Oh, that's right. There's a show next week at Showbiz, but the show is over for Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus after 146 years.
Yes, it's pretty remarkable. And, you know, I guess
it's remarkable they had such a long run.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because I cannot remember the last time I went to the circus.
Well, like 10 million people do a year. But when some people said, well, oh my gosh, why is this tradition? Well, it's competition, right? It's Cirque du Soleil. It's, you know, they are playing to tens of millions of people all over the world. They grossed $800 million last year. They have sit-downs in numerous cities all around the world. They have traveling circuses. And they've inspired a whole bunch of other small circuses and innovative troupes. And they don't use animals. And so, you know, Ringling Brothers got lapped by the competition. That's what happened. You know, they didn't change. Their modus operandi didn't change for decades. And now they've faded away. But, you know, what a heck of a run.
Well, yeah, and think about it. When Barnum and Bailey, or, you know, Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey, was, you know, two circuses that kind of combined. When they were around, you know, you wanted to see an elephant. That's where you went. You went to the circus to see an elephant. There was no zoo with an elephant nearby.
And certainly no zoo with an elephant in a habitat that was not wildly cruel.
Well, that's true, too, yes.
They were given space, and nowadays they're given the space and the thing to at least have a somewhat decent habitat and quality of life.
I want to say it's a shame, but I think it's somewhat anachronistic these days, the circus.
Well, no, the circus is all over the world. People love the circus. It's just not this particular company.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is the Ringling Brothers version of the circus is anachronistic.
Yeah, just not that. I don't know. Yeah, just not that good.
That's another way of putting it. What you're saying is if anachronistic means not good, then yes, I agree.
That's right. And I agree we're going to have a show this week. What will we talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll look at the wreckage of this weekend's box office, where three high-profile films crashed and burned. See, says Hollywood, people won't go to the bad movies we make anymore. It's a disaster.
Please no. Please no.
Okay. I was going to... All right, fine.
No Trump imitations, please.
Really? Because if I was doing a Trump imitation, I would have said you had say it twice. I would have had to say everything twice. Meanwhile.
Keep going.
Okay, well, meanwhile, the end of the year movie awards keep coming in with nominations announced by the guilds representing directors, producers, cinematographers, and costumers. During our book filter segment, Michael, you're going to spot one property Hollywood can bungle, and another one perfect for a woman of a certain age. On Inside Baseball, we'll stick with publishing. We're going to look at the past year in publishing, from what we know about book sales to the far more important fact of what we don't know about book sales, and then onto the growing popularity of ebooks at your local library. And I can actually talk about this with knowledge, Michael, because I actually borrow ebooks from several libraries, in fact.
So have I.
My question is all of this the end of the world or a lifeline for the industry, these ebooks at local libraries? We'll find out. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have links to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profit, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, and on and on. And it's a four-day weekend here in North America. It's Martin Luther King holiday this Monday, which means there's a little bit of extra box office dollar being scooped up today, and we've worked that into our summaries here on the worldwide chart. And everyone agrees the number one movie around the world is Passengers. $38 million over the weekend, thanks to opening in China. $237 million worldwide. Hey, it's a movie with movie stars, and they're getting closer to tripling their budget. So if China can hold on enough, they might just get close enough to $300 million to not feel like a flop.
It's pretty remarkable, don't you think? I mean, all of these movies, even, you know, I was kind of doing some work over the weekend. that Peculiar Children, you know, Mrs. Peregrine's Peculiar Children. Remember when that was released and it made $28 million and everybody thought, oh, Tim Burton's done, you know, he's just, you know, his movies are failing. The movie made nearly $300 million.
Right. Not great. Probably not enough for a sequel, but enough that they're not going to lose their shirt. And that's the safety net of big stars like Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence and big directors who can sell tickets like Tim Burton, a very rare director in that case, being able to sell tickets just on his name alone. It doesn't work all the time, as we're going to get to at North America's box office this weekend, but that's why you pay stars a lot of money. Not a lot of people enthused by this movie, but they're bringing them in. At number two around the world is a movie without stars, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. I guess there are stars, they're just planets and suns. $40 million over the weekend, $983 million worldwide. Actually, that should have been the number one movie around the world, I think, based on the MLK weekend. So, in fact, when we added in the Monday figures, the number one movie around the world, I'm now realizing, because I didn't flip them, is Rogue One. I don't think Passengers, did it make, it didn't make, it would have had to make $1.5 million to tie Rogue One, and I don't think it made that on Monday alone.
Well, as we record this,
pretty much faded from the box office here.
As we record this, you know, these numbers are coming in because we're recording early Monday morning.
That's right.
And so the actual Monday figures aren't available yet.
No, they're not.
And a lot of these are estimates.
I beg your pardon.
Yeah, they're estimates. You were going to say that they were estimates. I was saying that they were estimates, and that's how the studios do this. They call up the box office mojos and the certain media outlets, and they kind of give the reporters their estimates, and then later on, Comscore will come along and say, no, it was actually, here are the actuals.
Right, and we're comparing a four-day weekend in North America to three-day weekends in the rest of the world, but that's okay. We're just adding up all the numbers, and we're just saying who's made the most money in the last few days.
Right.
So it's a bit of a mess, bit of a magilla, but it looks like maybe Rogue One passed Passengers, and that is number one worldwide yet another weekend in a row. It's not number one in North America, but both of them made just under $40 million. Passengers is proving the durability of stars. It can work sometimes. Rogue One is just about to pass $1 billion worldwide. At number three around the world is La La Land. What a huge success story this is. $35 million over the weekend, and that's the movie's budget. Perfectly timed with the Golden Globes success, with critical acclaim, end of the year glory. Worldwide, it's made $130 million. It's already quadrupled its reported budget, and it's not even close to done yet.
Well, do you think there's any stopping this film from winning Best Picture?
I really don't. You know, given the combination of critical and commercial success, this feels like the one. You look at the success at the box office of Manchester and Manchester by the Sea and Moonlight, and I just feel like this one has so much more mojo. It's a long road to the Oscars, but it does feel like this is the baby. It's certainly the front runner, right?
I would say so. Yeah, at this point, I mean, it's as you say, everybody is singing its praise. I mean, critics love Moonlight. A lot of the guilds
and
love
Manchester
Moonlight,
by the Sea,
and they like Manchester by the Sea, and it's basically been going back and forth between La La Land and Moonlight as to who's gonna, you know, get the top nod from any one of these groups. But you know, when all is said and done, I think La La Land kind of a consensus, and not a bad consensus, but you know, it's the one that I think can rise to the top.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But when you have critical acclaim and box office mojo, that's a really powerful combination.
Well, owning a website has to do with any of this.
And number four is Sing, $32 million over the weekend, and it has passed $400 million worldwide, and it's not even close to done. And number five is Assassin's Creed, $24 million, $185 million worldwide. And number six is Moana, still packing them in, $20 million over the weekend. It's about to pass the $500 million mark. At number seven, the number one movie in North America, it's Hidden Figures, another really strong success story. They say they don't make movies for adults anymore, but Hidden Figures, La La Land, these are middle-range movies with middle-range budgets that are clicking significantly at the box office. Maybe you only get excited by billion-dollar movies, but I get excited when I say movies like this do great right out of the box. $25 million over the weekend, or 26, I should say, $60 million and counting, and that's only from North America. Surely they're going to want to make money with this overseas. I mean, but will they? Is Kevin Costner enough for them to say, okay, this isn't a black film, but a good, solid, entertaining movie that has wide mass appeal, which is what they should be saying?
Well, I think Janelle Monáe will help, actually. And I think actually the award season would help if it picks up a few nominations.
It'll be nominated for Best Picture, don't you think?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I haven't seen the film, but I just think based on the buzz that I hear about it, it's certainly doing quite well.
Oh, it's all in all the guilds love it. It's been, in a player in every award season. I think perhaps it's likes just a tad of gravitas that they like to see in a Best Picture winner. It's more of a populist entertainment, but that hasn't stopped movies before.
It's like The Blind Side in that regard.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Feel good movie. And Blind Side didn't win Best Picture.
No, it did not. I think it was not. Right. Was it nominated for Best Picture?
I'm pretty sure it was. Yeah. But, double check. I'm a fact checker. I don't ever want to go with my memory. I want to look it up. Where's Alexa? Did The Blind Side win the Oscar for Best Picture?
Great. Now you've just asked everybody's Alexas out there and I'm doing the same thing by saying the name. We have to.
Did it not answer you? I don't have one here.
I have you in my I have you in my headphones.
Ah, there you go. Oh well. And no, sorry, folks. At least you know the answer and we don't. Our entire audience knows the answer to that question while we are sitting here going, well, I don't know. At number 8 is The Bye-Bye Man, a horror flick, $15 million over the weekend. At number 9 is Monster Trucks. Here's a movie that did actually a little better, I think, than people expected. It's opened in 18 territories. It made $15 million over the weekend. It's at $25 million and counting. It got an A cinema score, and I don't know what that means, but it means people didn't hate it.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the IRS to come knocking at Paramount's door and say, hey, remember that write-off you took for this?
yeah, suddenly if it made $50 million, they'd say, oopsie-daisy. Yeah. But yeah, that's obviously not a lot of money. It's $25 million. They need to make $400 million in order to be in the black, roughly, worldwide. But it's not a god-awful start, that's for sure. It's certainly a lot better than they probably hoped for, or expected. And number 10 is Patriots Day, the Peter Berg, Mark Wahlberg movie, $13 million over the weekend. And number 11, the comedy, Why Him? $12 million over the weekend and $40 million, which is just matching its budget. We'll have to see where that one ends up.
This movie almost looked like it was made for DVD or Netflix. It was hardly marketed, at the end of the year. It was released, but not to huge fanfare, maybe because it wasn't a great movie, but you almost wonder what were they thinking when they made it?
Middle range, comedy, counter programming, like Dirty Grandpa and, a million other movies.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. The Great Wall made $10 million over the weekend. That's just passing $200 million. That's the Zhang Zhimu epic from China. And number 13 is one of several movies that flopped hard in North America as far as the critics Hollywood is concerned. One of them was Monster Trucks, but we also had two very big high-profile movies, Ben Affleck's Live by Night and Martin Scorsese's Silence. Both of them really opened poorly. People simply just turned away. They didn't want to look at them. just said, no, I'm not going to see that movie about priests. I'm not going.
Well, you look at that movie, Hollywood Silence, mm-hmm. and it does not look like a fun film.
Right. But it's a passion project for Martin Scorsese, a great novel. Live by Night, a fun mystery by Dennis Lehane, who wrote, what was that big movie?
The River, something about the River.
Mystic River.
Thank you. Yes. Wow.
A terrific standalone mystery. I interviewed him about that novel and a series of a really fun crime novels. Now this is part of a trilogy of novels. They probably expected and hoped to make more of them. But, they were making The Godfather in their minds and it opened up and people just didn't go. And this is Hollywood's example number one. Big star, big movie, and nobody will even show up. And they feel like this is the new world they live in and it's upsetting.
You know what's really upsetting is that you asked me what movie Dennis Lehane's, what movie was based on a former Dennis Lehane novel or a past Dennis Lehane novel, and I can't actually remember the full name of the movie. That's what's really upsetting to me. I remember River.
Mystic River.
Yeah, I can't remember the mystic part. All I remember is Sean Penn and Kevin Bacon.
Well, that's true. That's okay. We're old, and you can look it all up, so it's very confusing. I've looked it up, The Blind Side, and that did not win Best Picture, as we believed. It won Best Actress for Sandra Bullock.
So what we really need to do is rename all of our Amazon Echo devices Michael.
Well, my question is Hollywood right? Is this a new world that we live in where they don't get away with those sort of cushion of being able to open up a movie and get some box office out of them? Is this really a new thing? I mean, there've always been some movies that just flopped, but there seems to be no room for error anymore. Is that valid?
Well, you know, everybody's been saying for some time now, at least everybody, you know, inside the industry, that there is no more bottom. It used to be that if you put a certain amount of money into marketing on a film with a particular budget, you could know within, you know, a couple million dollars where you're going to wind up. So if you have something that you think is really going to flop hard, you could market it and kind of jam it into, you know, into people's minds. People would go see it. Now that is not the case.
Right. And there was a safety net, right? First, it was that Hollywood was the only game in town.
That's right.
Then it was VHS tapes, which they fought tooth and nail, and DVDs and Blu-ray. And suddenly they were making more money selling and renting movies in the home than they were at the box office. That was a huge safety net for a while. And there was sale to cable. Then there's the international box office, which is huge. I mean, and again, I think that's a big safety net that for a long time, and it's still there, but these movies probably aren't going to play overseas either. Passengers is working, but Live by Night, Silence probably are not going to make big coin overseas. And so they feel like there is a safety net because the market is bigger than ever. They make more money than ever. There's more, you know, brass ring when you grab it, it's bigger and heavier than ever because you're making $1 billion. But yeah, there's a safety net because all those things are still there. There are just holes in it and more movies fall through. And it's true, I think. I do think they have a valid point, but the only solution, of course, is to make better movies, and that's not easy.
Well, was Sleepless any good? Did you see Sleepless?
Sleepless is the Jamie Foxx cop drama. I didn't see it, and it made $10 million over the weekend. And that's, again, proving how the bemoaning the fact that stars don't work anymore doesn't have a lot of validity because, you know, they can work and that this is a good example of it. I didn't see it and doesn't have very good reviews, but, you know, he opened it. It has attention. It has a certain name recognition now that it didn't have before. The same is true for Allied. This is a flop at the box office. It stars Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard. It made $8 million over the weekend and it passed the $100 million mark, which sounds like a lot until you realize the budget is $85 million.
Right. Yeah, they spent a little bit too much on that movie.
And, you know, there's no good result for this. It's only in 45 territories. I think it's fairly played out. But no matter where it ends up at the box office, it's probably not going to we know it's not going to triple its budget. And we know it's going to be a money loser, probably. But, you know, it's a name with big names. It'll be part of a library. They will, over the years, it's not going to be worthless to them. It simply will not make the money back, but it is still a property. It adds to your library. It has big names in it. It'll pop up on cable and people will watch it, right?
Yeah. Oh, Allied? Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's why you have stars and all that. It used to be you could make all your money back with all those ancillary markets, and it's not going to happen with this one, but it does cushion the blow. There is still a safety net, even for movies that flop pretty hard, but, you know, it's hard. When you're spending a lot more money than you used to, you fall harder when they fall down. And number 16 is Some Like It Hot, the Chinese romantic comedy, not a remake of the classic Billy Wilder movie, but it's made $70 million worldwide so far. And that's basically in, I guess, China and Hong Kong. And number 17 is Underworld Blood Wars, another $7 million. That's at $70 million worldwide as well. Your Name, the Japanese animated Monster Smash, which is just about to open up here in the U.S., $330 million worldwide. China has another animated film that opened this weekend. It's called Bakum Bear, or I think it's like Bernard is really what Bakum translates into. It's Bakum Bear Agent 008, and it's a new movie about a character who's, I think, had a TV series, is a clumsy polar bear, and in this movie he becomes a James Bond type figure. It opened modestly, and it's made about $7 million over, I think, like since Wednesday, something like that. I don't think there's anything new down lower. Silence flopped. It's made $8 million worldwide. Oh, here's one new movie. It's OK, Janu. I'm sure I'm butchering that. I apologize. It's a Bollywood romantic drama. It's a remake of a Tamil romance about a young couple who live together in sin, for God's sake. That's very shocking. They're not married. And as required by law, the score and soundtrack of the movie are by A.R. Rahman.
Now, I'm just going to say, before we get a whole bunch of emails, I'm pretty sure that's not a law. But I think it's a
really?
Tradition.
It seems like it.
There's a difference between tradition and law. And I think that might fall more on the tradition side.
You may be right. Well, that's the worldwide box office. And there are those flops that happens. But Rogue One worked. And one reason is you had the familiar characters. You had Darth Vader. You had Princess Leia. They're not going to be back, are they?
No. Well, Darth Vader might be back. But certainly Princess Leia, or young Princess Leia, as I like to refer to her in Rogue One, is not going to be back. And I don't know. Spoiler alert. I guess we should say that up front, right?
Well, it's made $1 billion. I think if you're not familiar with this by now, it's a little late.
Okay, well, Carrie Fisher, of course, passed away at the end of December. She played Princess Leia, for those of you living on, well, possibly another planet. And she appears...
Hopefully not... I can't think of the planet they blew up.
Alderaan?
Alderaan, thank you. I was going to say Arrakis, but that's Dune, proving what a geek and loser I am.
Alderaan is a peaceful planet. In any case, Carrie Fisher, who plays Princess Leia, who is from Alderaan, she played it in the original Star Wars trilogy and has played it in, you know, Episode 7, and she makes an appearance in Rogue One, the younger version of her, thanks to digital technology.
Right. Well, and after she died, people said, oh, my God, what's going to happen? And there was a leak that Lucasfilm has plans and they're negotiating with her family. And of course, you would think, I can't imagine they're doing that today because she just died. And in fact, they're like, excuse me, no, we're not talking to them about this right now. She just died and we're mourning. The fact is, she's already filmed her scenes for the next movie, Star Wars 8. So she will be in that film. And she was going to have a bigger role in Star Wars 9. That's the third in the new trilogy. And now they have to rethink that. They're not going to do a digital recreation of her as an old person because that's just not going to work. And they're just going to have to rethink the script. You know, they haven't shot that one yet. And they're just going to have to redo the idea, right?
Yeah, well, they kind of reshot the ending of Rogue One. And so they'll, you know, look, that's what? Yeah, they reshot the ending. They, you know, Tony Gilroy came and reshot that. So, you know, in this case, they don't have to reshoot. They can just rewrite.
Right. Okay. I see what you mean. Movies get worked over all the time. Yes.
Well, you know, this story about Lucasfilm kind of denying the rumors. I posted that to our Twitter account, by the way. If our Twitter account is at Showbiz Sandbox, if you want to follow us, and it was liked and retweeted. And so it just goes to show you a lot of people, you know, there's something about Princess Leia and Carrie Fisher.
It's a $1 billion franchise.
Okay, fine. Well, they work on
multi-billion
Twitter.
Multi-billion dollar, I should say.
Okay.
So I don't follow the studio executive shuffle the way you do because I just don't care, really. But Michael Linton left Sony for Snapchat. And the way they word it these days is not forced out or pushed out or fired or, you know, left of his own volition. They just say Michael Linton exits Sony because that's easy. That's accurate.
Well, it's so accurate. And the question is, I mean, Michael Linton was the chairman of Sony Entertainment. So that includes the music. It includes the film. It includes the entire, entertainment division for Sony, the electronics company.
And he wasn't having a good time, was he?
No, I mean, he oversaw the whole, you know, hack. He was there during the hack. I think he'd been there 13 years. You know, there was some question as to whether he would make it through that whole cyber attack and hack. And he did. Amy Pascal, the head of the studio, didn't. But he managed to make it through. And there's been a lot of executive shuffles at Sony that occurred after that. He managed to make it through all of that. But now he is stepping down to take over as chairman of Snap, which is the parent company of Snapchat. And Snap Inc. is filing for an IPO. So they need a veteran CEO, a veteran executive to come in and make Wall Street feel good. So, and he's already the chairman there. So he's going to be focusing on that full time, whether he was kind of asked to leave or pushed out, or whether he decided, hey, you know what, now would be a good time to leave of my own volition. Nobody knows. Well, people know, but nobody outside of Sony knows. And so it's kind of a natural transition for him.
Well, we know they've had a string of flops, don't they?
Well, there's that too. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, that's really what we're talking about here. You know, he hasn't been making good movies. It's on him and it doesn't look good. Is there anything exciting for him coming up? You know, is there anything in that he has put into place that should make people go, all right, they're going to be all right. Smurfs, the new animated Smurfs movie. There is a Spider-Man film in July. There's The Dark Tower with Ron Howard. Was Ron Howard still involved?
I don't know. That's a good question.
a remake of Flatliners, a remake of Jumanji, a new Bad Boys. You know, there's some stuff that might click, but there's not a lot of, you know, there's not a lot of stuff that's getting you excited when you just glance casually at the list. So, you know, I don't know. There wasn't a lot going on there. So, you know, he left of his own volition, but nobody said, oh, please don't go.
Yeah. Now, my question is, can he somehow make Snapchat understandable to me? That's what I want to know, because I've tried to use this thing. It's so convoluted, and I know that everybody under the age of 30 loves it, gets it, but I've tried to use it, and I'm just like, eh. Nobody I know is on it.
What don't you get? I don't understand.
No, I just mean, you know, I've tried to use it. I get it. I suppose not get it, but I just don't find it engaging. Mm-hmm. What about you? Have you ever tried to use it?
No, I'm old.
You're just like, no, but of course not.
Yeah. If I start using it, then all the kids will flee, and I want to let them have their Snapchat, and I want movies to have their awards nomination, because it is the end of the year, and so a lot of people are weighing in, aren't they?
They most certainly are. So we have, let's see, we have the DGA, the Producers Guild, the Cinematographers Guild, the Costume Guild. I think you and I kind of are nominating some people just because.
That's right, and I'd like to cut to the chase.
Okay, fine. You always want to just cut straight to the chase.
Do I? Is that a cliche I use a lot?
No, I'm just, you know, kind of mentioning. Okay. Yeah, no.
Well, I'm just saying, before we go down the breakdown of what these different groups have said, I feel like I've been wrong, that I've been poo-pooing this all season as sort of a media-driven obsession because it's Harvey Weinstein. But we're talking about the guilds now, not end-of-the-year critics or the Golden Globes. But the guilds are weighing in, and a lot of them are honoring Lion. And I think Lion is clearly going to be a player come Oscar time. I'm now at the stage where I might be surprised if it's not nominated for Best Picture. I think it will certainly get two or three or four nominations because the Directors Guild recognized it. It's the only movie that got a Best Debut and a Best Picture nomination. The Producers Guild nominated it. The Cinematographers nominated it. The Costumers recognized 15 movies, so that's a pretty broad net, but they nominated it. SAG did not name it a Best Picture nominee, but they gave it two acting nominations in supporting actor and actress. So that's a lot of guilds that have honored Lion, and I didn't think it was going to happen, but it looks now like Harvey Weinstein has done it again. He didn't get the editors or writers, but there's a lot of people who are enjoying this movie.
Yeah, and everybody I know who's seen it really likes it. They kind of come out going, wow, that was a really good movie. And that's why I was surprised people hadn't been mentioning it, you know, as far back as November and December as a contender. But of course, now that it's kind of been picked up by a few of these guilds, now people are really saying, oh, I better go see this movie.
Well, I feel the opposite. Everyone I know has not liked this movie. They think
really?
It's just boring and stupid. But nonetheless, the guilds are recognizing it. So it is going to be end of the year player. I mean, I think it will get a nomination for Best Picture. So Harvey Weinstein done it again. But let's focus in on the individual groups. What did the DGA do?
Well, they nominated a bunch of first-time filmmakers, as they do every year. And
I don't know about every year, really. Is that what they're known for? It's pretty remarkable. Every nominee in their top two categories is a first-timer in that category.
Oh, I meant first-time filmmakers.
There's two things. The DGA often recognizes directors again and again, Clint Eastwood, Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg. In this case, everybody's a first-time nominee, and a lot of them are very early on in their filmmaking career. Everybody in Best Director and everybody for Best Debut has never been nominated in either of those categories before. I don't know if that's ever happened before for the DGA, except the first year or the first few years they did it.
Okay, yes. Okay, I see what you're saying. What I was referring to was the category of first-time filmmakers, where, you know, the Deadpool was nominated and The Edge of 17 and Lion was nominated. These are all, you know, first-time films for these filmmakers. But
the category is Best Debut.
Best Debut.
So by nature, they're all going to be filmmakers who are pretty early in their career. That's what the category is.
I thought it was outstanding
director. There's no way those people can't be first-timers because that's the thing. They're saying, you're a new person. It's like Best New Artist. You are all Best New Artists. However they define it, they have to be first-timers there. But under the Best Director category, Those nominees are all new. They've never been nominated for a DGA before, so there's going to be a new winner. So, yeah, those other half, those debut artists are, in fact, debuts. Yeah, look at that. The guys they singled out as best debut are newcomers. Yes, that's true.
Well, really, where I was headed here was...
Oh, my God, every best new artist is a new artist. It's amazing.
Where I was really headed here was... Nate Parker for The Birth of a Nation was nominated.
It's his debut film.
It's his so debut
naturally
film.
He was in the debut category. You could be nominated for Best Director overall as well. A Best New Artist can also be up for Best Album of the Year. And Lion is the only film that has that honor. It was honored with a nomination for Best Debut. And they use that term loosely. It's not that it has to be your absolute first film. And in fact, you know, you can be nominated for an advertising award like some of them have been. But that movie was honored as Best Debut and Best Director overall. It's the only one to get that.
Yeah, well, of course, what I was referring to regarding Birth of a Nation is this is the film by Nate Parker, who, you know, in the middle of last year, he won the Sundance Film Festival with The Birth of a Nation, which is the Nat Turner story of a slave revolt. And then, of course, some allegations, some past allegations, which he was exonerated
for. We all are familiar with it.
Okay.
And we don't need to rehash it. He has not been getting any awards attention to speak of, and the DGA gave him in the first-timer category a nomination. It didn't put it up for Best Director overall, but it did give him some attention.
Yeah, what I thought was interesting was the trades kind of went, oh, it's back from the dead. I'm like, no, it's really just this one guild is actually kind of picking it up. I don't think anybody else will.
That's true. Who else got nominated for Best Director, which is akin to their Best Picture nomination?
Well, so we had Arrival. So Denis Villeneuve, I always mess up his name. Villeneuve?
I don't know.
Denis Villeneuve, even though Villeneuve really is his name. Kenneth Lonergan for Manchester by the Sea, Barry Jenkins for Moonlight, Garth Davis for Lion, and Damien Chazelle for La La Land.
That's right. And like you say, The Birth of a Nation was not up for Best Director overall. And the Producers Guild, the Cinematographers Guild, and the Costume Guild, even though they had 15 nominees because they have three different categories, they all ignored it. So it's a modest recognition for the movie, but it's not back on the radar for Oscars necessarily.
Correct. And then you have the Cinematographers Guild. You've got Lion, Moonlight, Silence, La La Land, and Arrival. I have a feeling that if La La Land winds up sweeping the Oscars, it will probably pick up cinematography.
Well, it's certainly in the running, right?
Yeah, well, and it was shot on film, and yeah.
Yeah. Well, that didn't help Quentin Tarantino's movie, did it?
No, it did not.
The Costume Guild has three categories, contemporary, period, and fantasy. So they get to name 15 films. So when come Oscar time, there's an awfully good chance that they will have named all five nominees in one of these categories, unless one of the categories is so weighted with great movies that they failed to capture them all. But, you know, there's 15 movies here. In contemporary, it's Ab Fab, Captain Fantastic, which Oscar voters also seem to love, La La Land, Lion, and Nocturnal Animals, which I couldn't stand, but for some reason keeps getting attention.
Well, think about it. So you're basically nominating Nocturnal Animals, which was directed by a fashion designer for a costume award. Okay, yeah, I can see that.
In period, it's The Dressmaker, Florence Foster Jenkins, Hail Caesar, Hidden Figures, and Jackie.
So in period, you're actually nominating a movie about somebody who makes clothing. Okay. Could see that too.
You can see that happening. Yeah. And in fantasy, tell me what's wrong with this category and what's good. Doctor Strange, Fantastic Beasts, and Where to Find Them, Kubo and the Two Strings, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, and Rogue One. Which one of these does not belong?
Kubo and the Two Strings. It's the first time an animated film has been nominated for a costume award.
Well, I strongly believe it does belong because the costumes are amazing. They create character. They're beautiful. The production design deserves to be nominated as well. Other people have said this. I'm echoing, I think, Variety or Hollywood Reporter or IndieWire. It's terrific to see that they did acknowledge it because they are being crafted and created. That's great. But there's a movie that does not belong in the best fantasy category. One of these five movies does not belong in the best fantasy category.
Oh, Rogue One?
Rogue One is science fiction.
Okay.
Can't the Guild call it the Sci-Fi Fantasy Award? For God's sake.
Okay.
That means Blade Runner is out of the question next year.
All right.
They need to learn the difference between sci-fi and fantasy. I'm just being silly.
Well,
what about the Producers Guild? They nominated their movies as well.
Yes, and this is where everybody's like, oh, Deadpool's on the rise. Everybody's going to, you know, Deadpool could get a Best Picture nod because we have Arrival, we have Deadpool, we have Fences, Hacksaw Ridge, Hell or High Water, which people are kind of forgetting about, but, you know, here they're kind of coming back, Hell or High Water being picked up by the PGA, Hidden Figures, La La Land, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. All nominated for best feature.
Well, but best producing job, of course.
Yes, of course, yeah.
I like how the Directors Guild nominates their directors, and then they list their team.
Yes.
The people who are, the people of different levels that work with the director to make the movie happen. I like that. And for producers, of course, there's a whole bunch of producers, and they name the ones that get the credit for not just sort of having their name on it or writing a check, but are actually involved in the work of producing. So that's cool to see. And Deadpool, you know, it's not one of my favorite movies of the year. I didn't love it, but, you know, I'd be thrilled, frankly, to see it get a Best Picture nomination, a Best Actor nomination, a Best Director, and a Best Screenplay. I think in the context of Hollywood, it would be highly deserved.
Yeah, I mean, look, they, you know, they basically took a superhero movie and said, well, everything's been done. How do we do this differently? And they did, and it worked.
Well, they didn't do it differently. They captured what makes the comic book great.
Well, that too. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, they were faithful to the comic book. They didn't put some new crazy spin on it. They did it the way the comic book does it. I mean, it's obviously a different medium, but they said, we got to do this and do justice to what's been created on the page. And they did. And it paid off.
But now, so, what about animation here? Because, and not to move us along, but I do wonder, looking at animation and the Producers Guild picks, you look at this list and you kind of go, well, that's kind of the picks for Oscar. You got Finding Dory, Kubo and the Two Strings, Moana, The Secret Life of Pets, and Zootopia, right?
Absolutely.
Which one do you think will wind up on top, not only here at the PGA, but come Oscar time?
Well, the PGA might be different. There might have been a challenge different for making Kubo and the Two Strings as an independent movie, somewhat, compared to Zootopia. But I think Zootopia is the best film, and so I can't help but think Zootopia is going to win the Oscar.
Yeah, I have a feeling, Zootopia... As much as, Kubo and the Two Strings has everybody's mind share, I guess, or, you know, everybody kind of really loves that film, I have a feeling Zootopia will wind up on top.
I think those are definitely the two that are fighting it out. I don't think Finding Dory or Moana or Secret Life of Pets as a player, I think it's down to those two.
Yeah, and, for documentary, normally we'd never go over all of these, but all of these categories. The Eagle Huntress, I think, is probably, although O.J. Made in America... was also nominated, and everybody seems to love that documentary. But The Eagle Huntress, I don't know, there's something about that film. It's like it keeps on going.
It's getting a lot of attention. It's doing really well at the box office for the type of documentary it is. O.J. Made America is just a great, great work of art, something I didn't think I wanted to see or have any interest in. It's terrific. The only drawback may be some people say, it's a TV show. So it played in theaters. It was commercially available. It ran in theaters. You could pay money to sit down and see it in a theater. So you know what? It's a movie.
Yeah,
and if you can honor it, why not?
I think it also played at Sundance last year.
It may well have.
Something O.J. related played at Sundance last year. There's too much OJ stuff. You notice that? There's too much, there's the whole...
Well, there's not when it's good.
Yeah, that's true. I guess. But now, speaking of good things, you, every week, you find a few good books for us to read and a few good books for Hollywood to maybe take a look at and pick up for adaptation, which brings us to our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And Michael, this week, what is your pick for the book of the week or the book that... you've selected with our listeners in mind?
Well, there's a couple books that are on the radar. One is At the End of the World. It is a book, a nonfiction work about a murder in 1941 in the Arctic Circle. That's about as far afield as you can get. It's an interesting, odd book. It's by Lawrence Millman, and he's written for Atlantic Monthly and Sports Illustrated. It's kind of a travel book. as he goes there today. Then it tells the historical story about this murder back in 1941 among the Inuit people. It's weird. It's a complex work. It deals with, you know, vanishing cultures. And Hollywood can ignore all of that and just zero in on the murder. And then they can have a white person come in and solve the crime. So I think it's the sort of thing that is such a quirky, strange thing. But Hollywood can ignore all that annoying stuff and just zero in on the thing that seems commercial and make a movie out of that. Because that's what Hollywood does, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
That's right. And, you know, to challenge myself and not to have that confirmation bias that we have, I read this book about Edward Snowden. It's called How America Lost Its Secrets. And it's a book about Snowden that is critical of him and suggests he, you know, gave secrets knowingly and willing to Russia, that he betrayed his country. And it's very much what a lot of the people in the intelligence community feel about what he did. For a lot of Americans and people around the world, he's a hero. For people who risk their lives and see what he did, they think he really damaged the safety of the country and that he is a bad, bad person. And this book looks at the timeline and the information we have and says, you know what, and raises some serious substantive issues about what he did, when, why, and how. So that's why I read it. I wanted to challenge myself and see if I would think about him differently. And while I do think about it a little differently, the conclusions I draw are pretty different from the author. But if you're interested in the case at all, and no matter where you fall in the debate about Snowden, I think you'll find some stuff here worth mulling over.
Well, and part of it is that he's a spy, right? Like that he was really a spy for Russia. And isn't that part of what the book is kind of focused on?
Well, not in the sense that you and I might mean the word spy. That's sort of how it's been described in the media. But there's not really anybody that says, oh, he was a player for them and that they played him and they used him. It's more that he ended up choosing to go to Russia and hand over secrets to them. Why that is complicated. I would say the U.S. government blocked off all areas of safety where he could go. He might have gone to Brazil. He might have gone to Iceland. Those countries were willing to give him safe harbor, and the U.S. should have let him go there. But instead, they wanted to punish him and make an example of him, and they sort of forced him to be down to only being able to go to Russia or China. You know, so that meant that this guy with documents in his possession was ended up going to our enemy. If he'd gone to Iceland, he wouldn't have been eager to hand over stuff to people. But if you go to Russia and you got documents on your hand, they're going to get them. And so the lesson is maybe perhaps not, you know, look the other way and be angry about ISIS, but let them know if they give him safe harbor, you're not going to punish them for. You may publicly chide them, but privately you're saying, I'd rather have him there than in Russia or China. That is the lesson I take. I also take the lesson that how we treat our prisoners and the international outcry over the treatment of Chelsea Manning makes people less likely to want to stay in the U.S. and face a trial, because the author's big point is, hey, if you're a whistleblower, you're supposed to man up, and probably a poor choice of terms since I just talked about Chelsea Manning, but you're supposed to tough it out and pay the price of being a whistleblower and being willing to go to jail. Well, the fact is, you might have just disappeared and never be heard from again.
Right.
And the treatment of people in America in solitary confinement is akin to torture and recognized by many countries as torture. So if you don't want people to flee the country and go to the enemy, perhaps not using torture and the brutal treatment of a solitary confinement is one smart thing you might want to reform in the American prison system.
Well, now,
boy, is this boring. Boy, have I gotten off on the track. But my review is incredibly long and complex, where I deal with a lot of the stuff he says. But he does raise some interesting points about what happened and when and what that means about what Snowden's intentions are.
Now, the he in this regard, okay, is someone named?
Edward J. Epstein.
Now, does that name sound familiar to you at all?
Oh, no.
It doesn't? It should. And here's why. And this is how long we've been doing this show, okay?
Oh, dear God.
On July 12th, or it was actually July 13th when we spoke to him, but for the week of July 12th, 2010, we actually had Edward J. Epstein as a guest on this show, Showbiz Sandbox, episode 62, The Secret Behind Hollywood's Accounting Practices, because Edward J. Epstein wrote a couple of books. The Hollywood Economist was one of them, and The Big Picture, Money and Power in Hollywood, and he was a guest right here on this program.
Well, that was 300 episodes ago. No wonder I don't remember.
If you had, I guess, it would have been noteworthy, right?
Yeah, you know, his bias comes out in the book, and I'm sure I have bias too. But I mean, one of the sillier things he says is that, well, you know, Snowden was lying because he keeps saying he had no choice. He had to go to Russia. He could have just stayed in the U.S. He could have come back here. is what he says again and again in the book. And it's like, well, yeah, if he wanted to go to jail and never be seen from again, perhaps. Yes, he could have come back to the U.S. and faced arrest, but he probably didn't want to be arrested. So it's a little bizarre and disingenuous to say, well, he's lying when he says he had no choice but Russia. He could have come home. However, I do note that there is a book that is charming and is good and everyone can embrace. It's called Lillian Boxfish Takes a Walk. And it's a perfect vehicle for an actress of a certain age. It's about an 85-year-old woman named Lillian Boxfish. And she lives in New York City in 1984, and it's New Year's Eve, and she's headed to a party, and she decides to visit her old haunts along the way. It's charming. It's funny. My critic on Book Filter, Jana Rotter, really liked the book a lot, and it's worth checking out. And if you're an actress, it's worth optioning.
Especially if you're an 85-year-old actress.
Or 70 and want to play older.
Right, exactly.
If they option it and say that they heard about it on Book Filter or Showbiz Sandbox, that would be a big deal.
Ah, well, thank you for mentioning the words big and deal together, because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, the Force is with Los Angeles. Now, the city is not a Jedi Knight, but it will be the home of a $1 billion museum devoted to narrative art and funded by George Lucas. And before you think it's a glorified ode to Star Wars, it will be covering all the narrative arts, from Norman Rockwell paintings to the comics of R. Crumb to, yes, Star Wars movies and Hollywood in general. L.A. beat out Chicago and San Francisco for the honor, although it didn't really beat it out. Chicago kind of gave it some trouble, and so did San Francisco. But in the end, it came down to San Francisco and L.A., and L.A. won. Big deal or big whoop?
You tell me.
Well, I think...
You live there.
Well, I think certainly where they plan on putting it, yes, it's a big deal. It's around the corner from USC, where George Lucas went to college and film school. It's right next door to the L.A. Coliseum, where the 1932 and 1984... Is it 32? Well, the Olympics were held there at least in 1984, and I think it was 1932 before that. So yeah, it is a big deal. Now, whether it will actually be a big deal architecturally when it's done and programming-wise, I don't know. That remains to be seen. But based on the 10,000 pieces of art and objects that Lucas has in his possession that he wants to put in this museum, it could be a big deal.
I wish he'd bought Debbie Reynolds' collection.
Oh, that would have been fascinating. Although, again, this is more than just movies. This is about storytelling in general.
Sure. So there's TV, perhaps radio. I don't know. It's narrative art. Why not? So I guess it's more of a focus than just saying pop culture.
Right.
So it is the narrative arts. It'd be interesting to see how they arrange it and do it. But yeah, everything from comic books to paintings that tell stories to presumably radio, TV, and movies. So you like the location of the place. You think it's going to be a big tourist draw and could be an important cultural institution for the city?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, right next door, you have the Science Museum. The Natural History Museum is down there. You've got the new art museum, the Broad, in downtown. You've got the Museum of Contemporary Art in downtown. So, yeah, it's definitely downtown Los Angeles is undergoing a huge revival right now.
Very interesting. The Summer Olympics in 1932 were held in Los Angeles.
I knew it, yeah.
So there you go. And just like the 84 games, they actually turned a profit. And since it was in the midst of the Great Depression, that was kind of a big deal. They did a good job with that. It was the 10th Olympiad in modern times. And half the people that showed up 4 years earlier did not show up. I mean, it was not a well-attended Olympics because of even the president, Herbert Hoover, did not show up for the 32 Summer Olympics. But it was held there, and there you go.
Well, and now Los Angeles is bidding for the 2024 games, saying, look, we have the infrastructure. We can just use it. So, in other words, it would be the third Olympics in that particular venue. But that moves us along to our next story. And in a rather confusing one-two punch, the head of the BBC, Tony Hall, he said their digital online platform, known as the iPlayer, that it needed to be dramatically rethought out for the future. Then a week later, the BBC touted the fact that the iPlayer had its best week ever. Thanks to the Christmas and New Year's week being chock full of programming, people were eager to watch, like special episodes of soaps and comedies and the return of Sherlock Holmes. Indeed, about 70 million requests were made for live streaming or on-demand viewing of a Doctor Who Christmas special and the like, but that's for people who see the iPlayer as a fancy DVR, a way to catch up with TV. Now the BBC wants young people to see the iPlayer as a go-to source for TV all the time, though without spoiling the current massive audience it presently enjoys. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for both instances. I mean, they are seeing to the future and they're saying, yeah, it's working great now, but we want this to be a place where you start off, you know, watching stuff. And 70 million requests is a lot because the United Kingdom only has 65 million people. So that really should wake you up. That's like having 340 million requests for something in North America, or I mean, should say in the US. So yeah, it's hugely popular. People love it. People all over the world want access to it. I know that's true. And they're fighting that all the time. So yeah, I think they're being smart. It's confusing a little bit. Hey, we need to redo this. Hey, it's doing great. But they're right. You know, a fancy DVR is not enough for the future.
Well, maybe this next story might one day be in the George Lucas Museum of Narrative Arts. When is fan fiction encroaching on the valuable rights of a billion-dollar franchise? We're going to find out when the fan-funded Star Trek prequel movie goes to court in a case against Paramount Pictures. The fan collective worked with the studio every step of the way while raising more than $1 million for this professionally cast labor of love. But at the last minute, the studio said, hey, no. Then the new director and producers on Star Trek thought they'd worked out a compromise. But at the last minute, the studio said, still no, okay? And now they're going to court. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it was just unavoidable, right? I guess there was no other way of doing this to get along to what it would mean for this movie to be made and released in theaters. I mean, it's clearly not a fan film done for love online, is it?
No, not at all.
Right. Yeah. And I don't think they could have just let it happen and protected their copyright. But could they have just signed off on it and said, this is authorized and the profits are going to go here? Once, you know, we'll together say, all right, if this makes money, the profits go to this charity or whatever. You know, in that way, you can't do it without authorization and therefore they don't lose their copyright. And how often are people going to raise a couple million dollars to make a movie? You know, I mean, I understand their concern. You can't just say, well, we don't care, because suddenly you could have a pretty professional TV series about Starfleet Academy on YouTube.
Right.
And it would have nothing to do with Paramount. But these people worked with them every step of the way. So why this is going to court, I just don't know. If they got their approval, you think it'd be fine. So it's a big mess, isn't it?
It is. And it just kind of smacks of high-priced lawyers.
Or corporate, one hand not knowing what the other hand is doing, or, you know, lawyers getting concerned about something when they don't need to. Or, I mean, this isn't going to establish anything about fan fiction and what right fans have and studios have, is it? Because it's such a particular case.
That is
so
correct.
It's not going to have a wide impact, I don't think.
No, I mean, what it will do is it will be a chilling effect on other fans trying to do this type of thing. Whether it be Star Trek or something else.
But I mean, how often do people raise millions of dollars to make a movie?
Well, there was this one time where these fans of Star Trek did it. And yeah, I don't know. Not very often.
All right.
Now, some 90 million people, Michael, worldwide, they're paying a subscription fee to access a streaming music service. I do it for Spotify. Others do it for Apple Music. But clearly, that's not enough to provide even popular artists a decent paycheck. And it's not even enough to keep Pandora, the online radio station here in North America, it's not enough to keep them happy. The site is laying off some 7% of its workforce while trying to figure out its digital future in a world where their product is facing competition from, well, the likes of Apple and Amazon. The once free service added a $5 tier and has a $10 on-demand level launching in a few months. They acquired RDO, and analysts constantly expect someone to acquire Pandora. But if and when they do, Pandora will have 7% fewer employees. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal to the employees. Were they bloated? Did they have too many employees?
I don't know.
Did they just grow too big?
I don't know. That's a good question. I would have to.
Or are they just trying to clean it up before they sell it?
I think they're trying to clean it. Well, certainly they're trying to clean it up. They're trying to, you know, right their ship. I don't know how many employees they had. They're a public company. I could have done the research on this. I felt like, well.
Well, do you think it's just the competition? It's like, hey, they were one of two and now they're one of seven. And those are deep pocket people and it's hard to keep up.
Well, the latter. I think that basically there are too many players in online streaming. As much as I would love there to be more, the reality is you can't play on this level, you know, in the billion-dollar, million-dollar, you know, multi-millions of dollars, and expect to beat out an Apple or an Amazon, with two companies that can afford to lose money on their services in order
forever
to sell other products at a profit. So when, you know, the streaming service is your product, you have to make a profit on it. And it's just, it's really, I just don't see a lot of these services surviving.
And you do see Amazon as having to make original content, just like everybody else. I mean, they feel like they need to make original content to keep people happy with their service.
Well, right. I mean, so you see Amazon, you see Netflix spending as much as an HBO or a Showtime to make content that people will subscribe for. So, and literally that's kind of what was announced this past week, is that Netflix and Amazon, they're paying, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to, you know, produce content, their own content.
And now Apple is apparently going to do the same.
That's true. Actually, that should have been one of our stories this week, is that the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Apple is getting into the television and movie business, because that's worked out so well for everybody that's done that in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it wasn't on our list because they just sort of said, yeah, that you may see that. There's just still no actual information out there.
No, it was kind of,
I mean,
like,
we know they have one series that's being filmed about Dr. Dre, and they have another one that they're working on. Where right. It might end up, we don't know. There's no firm figures about a budget or what they're going to want to do. Are they going to create original? Are they going to back artists? Is it just music related? What's going on?
I wish I could tell you. I do not know.
Yeah.
The one thing I can tell you, Michael, is that you grew up in South Florida, a hop, skip, and a jump from Key West. So you know about music and musician Jimmy Buffett. And you knew long before Parrot Heads became a phenomenon and Margaritaville was a chain of bars, hotels, and well, I guess restaurants, although that kind of falls into the bar category. Buffett long ago proved he was a better businessman than a singer, and after expanding in those ways, not to mention comic novels and, of course, endless touring, he's headed to, guess where, Michael? Your backyard. He's headed to Broadway. Just not yet. The Jimmy Buffett musical dubbed, of course, Margaritaville, naturally, will hit La Jolla Playhouse in California, New Orleans, Houston, and Chicago, and then Broadway. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop, right? Everybody's back catalog wants to be turned into a musical so they can make a lot of money. I think they're going to these other places perhaps because they don't feel like they have a Broadway quality thing first. Or are they working on it to make it better? Or are they just saying, you know what, let's tour with this puppy and make as much money as possible with the brand before we head to Broadway and get better reviews? I mean, I'm talking about a show we haven't seen, but that's the vibe one gets. However, you know, Jersey Boys, that was the show you took guys to when they wanted to go to a Broadway musical. And you say, oh, you can take a guy to Jersey Boys. He'll be fine with that. And Broadway doesn't have that at the moment. They got a lot of musicals that are female friendly, but a musical that you guys can say, all right, I'll go. Margaritaville, that's your ticket, baby. So they might just well have a musical that would play great for the guys that are being dragged to Broadway. So, you know, it could work.
Well, and a lot of Broadway productions start, well, not a lot, but some Broadway productions start off at the La Jolla Playhouse.
Oh, absolutely. But it's the fact that they're touring in multiple cities that makes me feel like they say, you know what, we've got a brand name and we can make a lot of money before we put ourselves under the spotlight of Broadway.
And maybe that's a good thing. I mean, maybe, you know, workshopping it, if that's what you want to call it, in different cities will actually work out and help make a better product.
Well, assuming that that's what they're doing, that they do want to keep working on it at every stage, they may just, you know, create it at La Jolla and then tour it.
Yeah.
That's different from saying, we're in New Orleans, how can we make this better? We're in Houston, how can we make this better? But, you know, we'll see what they do.
The British company ITV sued the Duck Dynasty producers, accusing them of double dealing and making arrangements with third-party companies they had an interest in, ripping ITV off. Almost sounds like politicians. So naturally, the Duck Dynasty producers are suing right back. They say ITV are shady characters trying to drive down the cost of what they acquired and squeeze them out. It'll all end up in court unless they can all come to some nasty settlement and everyone walks away with millions of dollars and a lot of bad memories about a reality show flash in the pan. Again, sounds like our current government. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but I just while you read that, I just realized what the gay porn version of this show would be called.
I don't even want to know.
I'm sure that's been done.
I think that is a sure sign we should move on to our next story.
I have friends who say, why are they always named the porn version of some movie? Or I'm like, Oh yeah, that's been done. Anyway.
The UK channel Sky has dumped an upcoming TV film starring Joseph Fiennes as Michael Jackson in a road trip half-hour short about the time Jackson, Elizabeth Taylor, and Marlon Brando went on a road trip after 9/11. Is that at all true? Is that true?
It is.
Unbelievable. Was Marlon Brando still alive? I guess he was, right?
Sure was.
Stockard Channing plays Taylor and Brian Cox plays Brando. Why did they dump it? Because the Jackson family protested. Meanwhile, the Lifetime Channel in the U.S. has commissioned its own Michael Jackson movie about the final years of his life. Whether the family objects to it or not. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I guess it's a big whoop and it'll be seen somewhere else, but... does this make any sense to you at all?
Not a lick, because was Elizabeth Taylor and Brad? I know that Michael Jackson was friendly with Elizabeth Taylor. Everybody knows that. But I mean, there was a road. Could you imagine running into these guys on the road?
No, that was part of the charm of the movie. No, they stopped at McDonald's, I think. But the question is, why do they care what the Jackson family thinks? Did they think they were going to like it? A white man playing Michael Jackson in this nutty road show? I mean, they don't need their approval. They don't care what they think. So I don't understand what happened here. Like, did they actually care what the Jackson – then they wouldn't have made it in the first place.
That's true.
You know, so what's going on here? It's a half-hour episode of a show, and one family member tweets and goes, this is disgusting. Well, what the hell do you think they're going to say? So why in God's name did you suddenly dump it? These are big stars. We'll see this thing somewhere. Maybe it's a train wreck. Maybe they saw it and know it's a train wreck and wanted an excuse to dump it. That's all I can think about, because this makes no sense whatsoever. It's like saying, oh, well, Edward Snowden objects to our expose. Let's pull that book. Well, what do you think? Of course he's not going to like the book. You know, it boggles my mind.
Here's something that'll blow your mind, Michael. Of the top 250 films... okay, this year, only 7% were directed by women. That's a decline from 2015, when 9% of all films were helmed by women. Money knows no gender, because women were most prominent as producers, making up 24% of those on the top 250. They were 17% of executive producers and editors, 13% of writers, and 5% of cinematographers. Overall, they averaged about 17% of the credits on the top 250 films, down from 19%. One-third of all films had one or no women in key behind-the-scenes roles. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a very big deal, not in the sense that the numbers declined slightly from a year before, because when you're talking about so few numbers, it doesn't take a lot of women to drop out to make those, you know, percentages, you know, decline. 9% is like, that's like three women didn't get a job. That's because so few women are getting jobs in the first place. So the percentage thing, whatever. The fact is women are grossly underrepresented in Hollywood, and that is a problem. And here's another number for you, 54%.
Okay.
That's practically the population of women in America, and it's the amount of revenue that women generate at the box office. They are the ones who spend the majority of tickets. They are also the ones that make the majority of decisions about which movies to see, even when they're with men. And so women are there buying your tickets, choosing which movies to go to, and yet they are not involved in behind the scenes. That's just a dumb commercial choice by Hollywood. If they want to make movies that are going to appeal to women, it would behoove them to have women actually helping to make the movies.
Oh, I love that word, behoove.
Thank you very much. I like it too.
But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And last week, all these numbers came out from the publishing industry about the 2016 sales and well, there was just so many numbers I didn't even know where to begin. I mean, publishing had a quiet 2016. Sales were sort of steady thanks to adult coloring books more than, you know, books itself.
No, that's print.
Right. But there were no breakout hits. J.K. Rowling had a good year, and the stage sequel to her Harry Potter world sold 4.4 million print copies in North America alone. And she didn't even write it, by the way. But number two on the list of best-selling print editions is way back at 1.1 million copies of the latest Diary of a Wimpy Kid. At number three is Bill O'Reilly's latest work of popular history, this one being about Japan and selling 1.1 million copies. And that's it for the Million Seller Club. At 900,000 copies, you'll find the paperback edition of Girl on the Train. Girl on the Train also topped the list of Kindle bestsellers at the Amazon store. I'd say big deal or big whoop, Michael, but this is kind of interesting news.
Well, it is, and it's interesting how little we know. Publishers Weekly is the foremost industry trade paper, and they had two lists. One was the best-selling books in print, physical copies of books, and the numbers. And the other list was Kindle bestsellers 1 through 10, because they have no idea what the books are selling on Kindle. You know, and here's another figure. They estimate that 70% of adult fiction sales in 2016 were digital. Right? People talk about, oh, print is alive. It's like, it's not competition between the different formats, but people buy new books digitally. That's where the money is. That's where people are buying new books. And we don't know what the sales are. We have like, there shouldn't be any distinction between digital audiobooks and CD audio and a hardcover and a paperback. All the numbers should be put together, and we should say the best-selling book of the year sold this amount of copies. Well, maybe Girl on a Train is the number one best-selling book of the year. We don't know. That's how little we know, because so much of the sales happen at Amazon, and that's a black hole of information.
Well, but don't you think the publishing companies are getting that information? Because when
they're not sharing it with each other, and they're not sharing it with us, and it's complicated. And a lot of books are published by independent and smaller presses or self-published authors, and they're only on Amazon. And so their numbers aren't included. Perhaps a majority of sales almost are coming in independent presses and self-published authors. That's coming closer and closer. 20%, 30%, 40% of sales are not with the big five publishers. And all those sales are happening on Amazon, and we never hear those numbers.
So then where does the New York Times get their information from? When they say, here's the New York Times bestseller list, they actually say, here are ebook and hardcover and print book sales. They must be getting numbers from somewhere. Or maybe they're just not getting them from Amazon and saying, well, Amazon's not giving them to us, so we'll just take it from Barnes & Noble or whoever gives it to us, plus the actual hardcover and print sales.
Well, they like Billboard did once upon a time before they used actual figures from point of sale information.
Soundscan, yeah.
Right. The New York Times has a formula where they speak to different independent and large bookstore chains and get information and extrapolate from there what they believe the total sales are. So that's a formula where they do the best job they can to sort of get that information. When you look at the list of books, they don't have figures for them when they combine the list of ebooks and hardcover.
They don't. Not at all. No, they just say, number one, number two, number three.
If you go to the UK, you'll see actual sales figures. So it's a different tradition. Broadway, we know the grosses for every Broadway show. In the UK, we have no idea. They don't talk about it. In North America, ebook sales is a black hole. But we do know most sales of new books like Danielle Steele and thrillers by John Grisham and A Man Called Ove by Frederick Bachman, which was a big hit this year. Those sales are happening on ebook, and most of them are happening on Amazon, and we don't have good figures. A few weeks from now, the Publishers Weekly will publish a list of the best-selling books of the year by publisher, provided by the publisher, and we'll have some harder data, but still, a lot of it we don't know about. And so many of the titles are self-published or small publishers, and they're only happening on Amazon, and then we don't know anything about it ever.
Well, and the Kindle Unlimited readership is growing, right? I mean, this is the kind of the Netflix for books.
That's right. People keep talking about this possibility. You say, well, gee, I don't know. I mean, people don't read enough books to need a monthly subscription to it. But when you're on Amazon and you have a subscriber and you pay that big annual fee, you get it for free. So there is a Kindle Unlimited readership. There are people who have access to a library of books and they can just read what they want when they want.
Well, no, I'm a Kindle Prime subscriber. I don't get Kindle Unlimited. I'd have to pay for it.
Really? I thought it was part of the package.
No. You'd have to pay for it. It's a separate subscription.
How much extra is it?
Enough that I said no. I mean, I'm not. I think it's $9.99 per month.
Is that much?
Yes.
For people who have Amazon Prime?
I believe so, yeah. I don't read fast enough for me to need that.
Well, most people don't, but the readership is growing. So there are people who are voracious readers, and the library that they have grows. And if you are somebody who wants to read a mystery or a cozy mystery or a sci-fi book or a romance book and you want to read, you read one or two a week, well, by God, it starts to make sense for you. And that readership is growing. That's one of the big trends of the year. There was an article at Digital Book World, which is one of the many sites I go to try and stay on top of the business. And that's one of the trends that they talked about. Small presses are dominating now. They may be a majority of book sales in North America. The big five may have fallen below 50%. Ebooks are where all the action is happening for nude fiction. That's where sales are happening. Amazon imprints. Talk about Kindle Unlimited. Amazon has imprints, which people reacted with horror to at the beginning. Well, they're getting bigger and bigger. Of the 10 best-selling Kindle bestsellers, 7 of them were from Amazon. They published them themselves. And of course, they promote them themselves. So they are the publisher. They are the seller. They are the middleman. They are there every step of the way in that food chain. So it's really, and one other trend is that audiobooks continue to grow. Amazon, again, is powering that happening as well. They help authors create audiobooks. They help promote digital audio. They have a free monthly service that you can subscribe to and get access to free digital audiobooks all the time. And that's working really well. That's a big, big, beyond coloring books. That's where all the growth is happening in publishing right now.
Well, and apparently Kindle Unlimited has, you can kind of borrow magazines.
Sure. Yeah. They have magazines. They have all sorts of things on there. Did you look up what the price is?
$9.99.
Oh, really? For everybody, even if you're a Prime subscriber?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's a little bit higher than I expected.
Yeah, it would be nice if it was $5, I probably would do it and then cancel some of my magazine subscriptions.
And are there magazines that you like to read that are on there?
That's what I'm trying to figure out right now as you're going over this information. I probably should be paying attention to what you're saying, though, right? I mean, that would probably...
No, not at all. I do that all the time.
Okay.
But, when you're talking about paying out money for digital books and physical books, it adds up and you might just head to the library.
Actually, that's what I do. I go to the library. So when I was in Sun Valley, for instance, I am Ketchum Public Library cardholder now, and I can check out ebooks from the library, not only in Ketchum, but also in my hometown here in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Los Angeles County Library. Speaking of which, I actually have an ebook on hold right now, and today is the last day that I can check it out. Otherwise, they'll let the hold go. It's one of Maria Semple's books. And so I can check it out, read it, and then return it.
And you never have to go into the store.
Or the library.
That's right. Yeah, I do that too. I always have a library card in the city I live in, like New York, and I have access to one in Birmingham, Alabama, because I'm there a couple months a year. So it's great. And according to Overdrive, that's the third-party company that works with libraries and publishers to be a middleman to provide backroom support so they can do things like make ebooks and digital audio available. According to them, and they are the it player, they're the main game, almost 200 million ebooks were borrowed from libraries in 2016. That's up 21% over 2015. That's a couple hundred million ebooks, perhaps one for every adult in America. I mean, there's 330 million people in this country. That's a lot of ebooks, and that's only going to keep growing.
Yeah, no, and it's a phenomenal service.
I mean, it's great. And some people say, oh, you're cheating. It's wrong. It's terrible. You're cheating. No. The library is there to make information available to everybody. And when you think about the people that libraries serve, there are a lot of people who aren't close to a library. They have their local library is far away, or they're elderly, or they have physical challenges, or it's not easy to get them to the library during the day when libraries are open. So for people who have physical challenges or who are homebound or elderly or don't have transportation to get to the library, which isn't convenient to them, and that's a lot of people in a lot of parts of this country, being able to check out books without having to physically go to the library, that's a godsend. So it's a great thing. And it's going to keep growing, and people pay for it to happen, and the publishers get a lot of billions of dollars of sales by selling stuff to libraries. So it's a good thing for everybody all around. The more you read books at a library, the more likely you are to buy books. And those books are being paid for anyway, so it's a win-win situation.
So I guess my question is, with all of these ebooks selling, is print dead?
No, absolutely not. There are always categories that will make sense for print, like cookbooks and art books and picture books with kids. There are always going to be people who want to put a book on a shelf. But I do think we're at more of a pause. I mean, pause. 70% of fiction titles were sold on ebook. That's not, you know, that's a vast majority of books are already digital. So, I mean, the future has arrived. That's how people are reading books. And I think it's, I can't imagine why it would change. They're cheaper, they're quicker, they're easier. You can get them everywhere. I think the only thing holding it back is people who only read on tablets and laptops or phones, in which case long-term reading on that is not really friendly to your eyes. I much prefer a dedicated e-reader. So I think the only reason it's even at 70% is for that reason.
Well, so you're saying print is still alive. However, there are some people who are no longer alive, which brings us to our obituary section. And this week we have, I guess, two obituaries to talk about. Casting director Ann Brebner died at the age of 93.
Yeah, she was closely associated with George Lucas, wasn't she?
She was. This is like the George Lucas episode. The first reading of Star Wars was in her office, in fact.
That's right. And she was with him early on, and he proved loyal to her. I mean, she did THX 1138, and that was really, you know, taking a flyer on that one. I'm sure that was a very low budget movie.
It was.
Then she did American Graffiti and did a terrific job on that movie. And then she helped him with Star Wars.
Yeah, and I think it was at American Graffiti where she found a little actor named Harrison Ford.
God, I hate when people do that so much. A little known movie called Gone with the Wind. It's so annoying. It's so cheesy. Oh my God. Yes, certainly that was, he was in that movie. Yeah, I don't know if that was his actual first role, but I think it was certainly a breakthrough role for him. She also did Harold and Maude, The Conversation, The Right Stuff. These are great movies with great casts. And Star Wars, you know, Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, Mark Hamill. None of them were big names at the time, and they all had very substantial careers. And that's when you know a casting director has really scored tremendously.
Well, Mark Hamill had a substantial career, I guess, in some quarters, yes.
No, absolutely. He does voice work. He's still known. I mean, he's absolutely.
Okay, all right. Well, speaking of being known, William Peter Blatty passed away at the age of 89. He is the author of The Exorcist.
That's right. That's his claim to fame. He did work with Blake Edwards on a number of movies, including the first Inspector Clouseau, Shot in the Dark. But yeah, Exorcist, that's on your tombstone. He was a ghostwriter for Dear Abby on a book that she did about advice and relationships. But you know what? He did this book. It was sitting there. It wasn't doing great. And then suddenly he got on the Dick Cavett Show.
So wait, when he was writing this book about relationships, did he mention that, like, look, if your date's head spins around 360 degrees and she starts puking out pea soup, probably not the girl for you?
Yeah, that's right. So Harrison Ford got a lucky break when Ann Brebner said, I love this guy. I'm putting him in American Graffiti, and I'm going to put him in Star Wars. William Peter Blatty got a break when he was sort of the standby person that somebody had thought about to put on the Dick Cavett Show. Robert Shaw was on the show, but he was drunk and they couldn't put him on air. Another guest canceled at the last minute and they needed someone to replace them. So that ended up being William Peter Blatty. He got on the show and then his segment was extended because Shaw was backstage pounding him back. And suddenly he had like 45 minutes on prime time on network television with Dick Cavett. And they did great together, sparked interest in the book, which was already in stores. It shot right to number one. The studios paid attention to it. They optioned it, and the rest is history.
For William Friedkin, especially.
That's right. Talk about his claim to fame.
It's, well, The Exorcist. Well, no, The French Connection, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our claim to fame, however, is this show, really. And we do it every week. And you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free is usually where you can find our show. And you can rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do that. That information can be found on showbizsandbox.com, our website. And if you can't find our podcast, you're probably not listening to this, but if you can't find it, then please do write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information, along with, links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode and ways to follow us, at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle on Twitter. And if you search for Showbiz Sandbox on Facebook, our page should come up and you can like us there. All of this information, again, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's womensmarch.com. Oops, politics.
Yeah, well, and that actually might be a real website, so...
It is a real website, absolutely. Oh,
okay. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to the Huffington Post, or you can head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget about bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.